coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Everybody, how you doing this evening? Hope everybody's had a great week. We had a great time talking with Mike Turber last week. It's been a hot minute since we had him on, but hearing more about the crazy balloon fiasco, man, the wildness with the balloons going over near Alaska, all that kind of stuff, the fact that they were actively tracking underground stations with the huge, massive Chinese balloon. It wasn't like some small weather balloon, folks. It was like the size of three city buses. It was like a small satellite suspended from a balloon using public Wi-Fi the whole way. That was my favorite, just bouncing from Wi-Fi to Wi-Fi signal, sending its data. So thank you so much, Mike Turber, for coming on last week. Our good friend Earl Gray is our guest in the second segment tonight. We will be talking about the recently released Aero documents, which of course you can find. Go to CuriousRealm.com, hit up the Knowledge Vault, and just click Declassified Government Programs. And you can see right there at the very top is the Historical Report Volume 1 from Aero, which goes into a crazy number. I mean, you can see all the way back to 1945, investigatory programs into UFOs, UAPs, that kind of technology. So, we'll be getting into that document, what it means for the world of disclosure, what some of the things inside of it mean, what Mr. Fitzpatrick's departure from the Aero office means so soon after making it. I personally think it's a dusting of the hands and letting other people take over so it doesn't become an entrenched position. That's just me, though. We'll see. So we'll be getting into that with Earl Gray. Our guest in the first segment is our good friend, author of A Moment Called Man, Nathaniel Gillis. How are you doing this evening, bud?
Thank you, brother. It's great to be with you.
There he is.
I'm glad to be with you. Yeah, I'm trying to fix everything. There we go. It looks different on like that, my feet and your feet. So I'm trying to make sure everything is good. But I'm glad to be back with you, my friend. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was funny because Earl, I noticed earlier, posted the link on social media to the show and was like, man, I do not know what a demonic molter is, but I got to tune into the first segment and find out. And not too long ago, we actively had Richard B. Spence on, who I love. I love Richard B. Spence. His work is fantastic. I highly recommend it, folks. Go on by, I guess it's now Wondrium. If you're an Amazon user, you can go to Wondrium and start up an account, and you get all kinds of great stuff. Like, I've taken literal quantum physics classes from MIT professors on there. It's great. He's got one on secret societies and one on the history of the occult. And we had him on recently about his class on the history of the occult. And it's interesting to me, Nathaniel, to hear somebody who is an avowed agnostic, not religious in any way, shape or form. I'll say agnostic because I don't think he said atheist. But definitely not like a church going individual, not somebody who's like, oh, you know, the Bible is the divinely inspired word of God. But to hear him as a professor, somebody who was non-spiritual, say basically the exact same thing that you have said, that there is a race of critters out there that have existed for apparently a long, long time that use the tropes of our mind as their back door of consent to basically use us as a living vehicle to carry them forward through time. And to breed and everything else. So to hear him say that, to hear him be like, You know, it's like, I'm not religious, but it seems like this is the case. And it was like, wow, wow. So I had to have you back on the show to talk about this, because it is one of my favorite topics. You know, I love the idea of and of course, the stories of Nephilim, things like that. And they have popped hugely into the paranormal subculture lately. But how did you first come into the world of demonology and demonological study, Nathaniel?
Well, I encountered an entity in my youth that was malevolent in nature. It was profoundly deceptive. And I realized that whatever this was pretty much encompassed a lot of the paranormal field itself. I mean, I was waking up in the middle of the night hearing a full conversation going on. I couldn't hear exactly what they were saying, but yeah. I heard two entities conversing with each other. Really weird stuff. But more than anything, I started to realize that a lot of the ways this being was manifesting to me was predicated on what I would have a fear of. And along with that, it wasn't just the cognitive interface, the phenomenon employed, but it was the projection of terror that it was filling the room with. And so I came to a conclusion one night, you know, I don't really believe this fear is coming from me. It was too paranormal, it was too supernatural. Whatever this entity was using me almost as a source, feeding off of the terror it was projecting upon me. And so that was instrumental in my development as a researcher. I wanted to understand, first of all, am I alone in this? Am I going crazy? Or is this something that is global? Are experiencers present within every country? Or is it just a little boy in Dayton, Ohio? And sure enough, it was, like I said, it was instrumental in my evolution as a researcher. But moving right along, to answer your question specifically, once I got into demonological literature, I realized that there was a common thematic element, regardless of culture, regardless of what incarnation this intelligence has given us, it's prevalent. It's what's called pattern-confirming evidence. And that's when I realized, okay, there are some behavioral patterns here that I can no longer afford to ignore. I had to destroy the walls that has compartmentalized this phenomenon and started to build bridges. And sure enough, I realized, okay, it's almost like I stumbled across something, my friend. Yeah. And perhaps I wasn't supposed to, but here we are.
Well, and the not supposed to is an interesting concept. You know, I will never deny I'm a former Roman Catholic seminarian. Like to kind of say recovering Catholic. I don't really go to church. I'm not really a practicing Catholic. I still hold a lot of my faith very close, very near to my heart. And I talk to my God on a daily basis. But I will never deny the fact of what my church did to hide such things, to even diminutize the world of demonic possession. You know, there was a day and a time where, yes, everybody, there was an exorcist per diocese, like that existed at one point, especially long ago in old Vatican I days. And they are trying to get back to that, to the point that they actively reopened the College of Exorcism in Rome, all kinds of things. But yeah, for a long time, that was one of those things that was kind of softball pitched by the church, which I think is to the detriment of everybody. And I'm not one who is uber religious, so to speak, you know, but it's one of those that if you're out there and you are teaching a paradigm, you need to be teaching the full paradigm. I mean, even whenever I went to my spiritual director at one point with my experience of a shadow person grabbing me, and they're like, well, you know, we don't really have a teaching on anything like that. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure we have exorcism and all kinds of stuff. Like,
yeah, like, we better have a teaching on that. What do you mean?
Yeah. And literally my words were, you cannot ask me to accept faith on spectral evidence. And when provided evidence of the spectral, be like, You know, well, like I have.
It's not just Catholicism, my friend. I experienced that in my church too.
Well, and yeah. You know, let's kind of explore that for a minute, because I once yeah. again, it is that idea. I'm not going to say that they're trying to hide it. That they mm-hmm. are. I think that these things are, at least these religions that have softball pitched it and kind of put it to the background. I think that they've just kind of gone wayward. I'm not trying to say that they should be more hardcore. Anything like that, mm-hmm. but it's one of those, like, man, you can't say that something is spiritually stalking you around every corner on one note and then be like, mm-hmm. you know, not going to touch you though.
Yeah. Yeah. No big deal. No big deal at all. Yeah. You know, that's what I experienced too. And that's when, I mean, honestly, that's when I started to kind of go a different direction. Yeah. My mm-hmm. research was going through, you know, demonology according to Catholicism, demonology according to different monotheistic traditions. And I evolved into a position I'm holding now where it's, I believe that we have misinterpreted what possession really is. We have literally framed it as some kind of religious experience when it appears to be the self-replication of a species. Yeah. that yeah. is self-replicating by virtue of the parasitic host hybrid relationship. And if we look at it through that lens, then it makes perfect sense as to why these beings, again, are implanting consciousness into women and their fetuses and harvesting both at the same time. What are we witnessing here? It is, again, it is an evolution of an intelligence. And if we look at that, instead of saying, okay, that's an entirely different field, like I said, if we take yeah. that and place it within the context of the hybridization program, then we can take a step back and see the height, width, and dimension
yeah.
of this phenomenon itself, not just one aspect of it, but as an entire process of, yeah. of self-replication.
Well, and it, you know, it's interesting because there are a lot of parallels, and many people, especially of hard right Christian thinking, very fundamentalist mm-hmm. Christian thinking, many of them bring up the fact that, you know, UFOs, aliens, they're demonic entities, things mm-hmm. like that. And there are a lot of parallels between the abduction phenomenon, mm-hmm. Between the impregnation of people, between the disappearing of fetuses.
Absolutely.
That's
irrefutable, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need to, yeah, right. That's irrefutable. And the problem with the field is this. We have ufologists who project a Catholic understanding of demonology upon the entire field of ufology.
Yeah.
And if that model yeah. is incomplete in and of itself, then that means your assumption about both of them possibly being the same is incomplete too. And this is why I had to separate myself, because people are like, okay, why don't you just go to academia? Why don't you go to a school of theology, go to a Bible college and be taught? Because they're going to teach you one side. They're going to present it in such a way where, okay, this is what I want you to believe.
Yeah.
And so I realized, okay, I want to be an independent researcher. I want to come to my own conclusions. I don't want to be limited by the dogmatism of one certain religious tradition. And what you know, because of that intellectual liberty, now I've situated myself in the field where it's like, okay, what is this really? You know, are these even horns and hooves? I'm collecting evidence now that is suggesting that that's at least some of this phenomenon that is appearing as demonic is an intelligence that's masquerading as such. And
sure.
That's interesting. You yeah. know, horns and hooves. Okay. Yeah. Well, I saw a demon with horns. Where did that tradition originate? Right. It's fascinating.
That was quite literally, and I've spoken with you about it. I've spoken about it on the show, but that is quite literally one of the first experience. I just did a session of NLP in mm-hmm. this studio the other day. And one of the first things was go back to the first time you remember feeling fear. And I went back to myself at 4 years old in Crosby, mm-hmm. Texas, in the tiny little trailer that we lived in, looking at my neighbor's house across the backyard, past our old rusty swing set, and next to the swing set, seeing a shadowy figure with horns and a tail beckoning me to come out to him. Mm-hmm. I've got goosebumps right now thinking about it, Nathaniel. That is still to this day my whenever I feel fear, that's where I go, is that experience. And yes, it's interesting to me that even at 4 years old, how was it that I had the quintessential, like, devil on the side of the can of ham devil?
Correct.
With horns and tails. How was it that that was preternaturally inside of me, or was it something that was projecting a preternatural image, you know? And like, you just got done presenting all of this stuff at a recent conference. Let's get into your presentation a little bit and some of the things that you got into over there at the Awakening Conference.
I can't go into it all, but
sure.
It appears we're dealing with a self-replication of species that will use what are called screen sequences or virtual reality scenarios to bypass our instinctual awarenesses. Something that will use a cognitive interface that is created out of archetypes we believe in or that we've heard about, authority figures, and then it will wear that mask in order to get us to a place of consent. And then at that point, and oftentimes, it removes the mask entirely. And then we realize, okay, that's not at all what has been occurring to me, number one. And that's not really what the SD looks like, number two. In the first the first case studies documented in history of that particular phenomenon is your incubi and succubi, bar none. Long before we had, you know, entities abducting people, we had beings taking women and men on what are called demonic flights. Now, I'm not trying to define them as such. I'm just trying to give us the working vocabulary of these experiencers in the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. In what was happening, it's fascinating. The very first case studies included beings that were inducing people into dreamlike states. And this is going to kind of freak people out, but sometimes the actual induction into a dream was designed for that entity to enter the dream itself. Matter of fact, and I'm going to give you a case study of mine, my own life, my own experience. Years ago, I was engaged and I came home from work on a Friday night, took a shower, went to bed, and I'm immediately in this deep sleep. And in the nightmare, because it was a nightmare, there is a featureless shadow woman, long hair, couldn't see anything on her face, just completely like a shadow. And she's straddling me. And in the dream itself, I'm pushing her off. I'm trying to get her off of me. And I'm reaching out like this. And I actually wake myself up from the dream. And when I do, upon when my eyes adjust to the darkness, to my utter astonishment, the entity was still present in the room, still on top of me. How can it be in two places at once, in two different realities, in two different streams of consciousness? Makes no sense at all. And so I fear, ladies and gentlemen, that whatever we're dealing with is stranger than we imagine. I'm going to pull a Terrence McKenna quote, and stranger than we can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it's way different.
I'm a sleep paralysis sufferer. That's when I had my shadow person experience of them grabbing me. And it was one of those, it was a sequential thing. Like, I remember waking up throughout the night and at one point, like, seeing it behind me, you know, things like that. And how is it that it can exist in both dream and in reality? You know,
absolutely. We don't have the vocabulary for that kind of intelligence, you know, and I'll tell you what, going through these case studies, not just in antiquity, but witchery literature, and even in modernity, there is a relationship between the dimension they're pulling us into and the scarifications we're finding on experiencers. But I mean, absolutely, like in witchery literature and in incubi cases, where even some of I've worked on myself in my career, where it appears to be a nightmare. And yet when the experiencer wakes up the next day, there are scarifications and bruisings that correlate directly with that encounter in the nightmare. And so the question is this intelligence manipulating consciousness, or, you know, influencing the soul itself? And then once it gets back into the body, then it manifests through the skin. There's evidence that suggests that. But again, that puts us into a category of not alien or demon. It puts us into a category of intelligence that's wearing both of these cognitive interfaces, hoping that we'll never truly see beyond the veil.
Yeah.
But make no mistake, whatever we're dealing with, we've seen this in Ian Stevenson's work, we've seen this in EQI literature and out-of-body experiences, that there is a relationship between what happens, what's happening to the soul, and what's manifesting through the skin to the surface. And that is disturbing.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, there really is a, there's a huge mind-body connection. And yeah, you know, you do have to kind of ask that deep philosophical question of the root of the soul. And is right. intelligence and consciousness the soul, you know, because at some point there has to be a differentiation, right, between us and these others, I'd like to say homunculi, but they aren't created necessarily. I guess right. that they were created at some point. But how far back do these stories go, Nathaniel? Mm-hmm. And how long have, especially the cases of impregnation, been happening?
Well, we have ritual bulls in Mesopotamia where they're actually incantations designed to ward off a demon named Lamashtu. And this particular entity would descend down upon women, pregnant women, while they're sleeping, stare into the eyes of them, the victim, stare their eyes rather, and then in some way, shape, or form, the mother wakes up the next day and the baby's gone. And one of the ways, this is interesting, one of the incantations and rites employed was to create a second face that looks like the mother's face and to wear it as a necklace. So at that point, they would go to bed, go to sleep, hoping that when that entity descends down and stares into their eyes, it stares into the wrong face. Thereby, they get to keep the child. But the hybridization program, again, is not modern. That's what disturbs me about, you know, a lot of the, okay, yeah, well, this is a new phenomenon. No, it's not. The behavioral patterns are not new. Matter of fact, the technology they're employing is not new. This is, again, this is what leads me to believe that this is a singular intelligence that is promoting propaganda. And what's happening is to the limitation of the researcher, to the point where it's like, okay, I've never researched beyond where the intelligence wants me to. Because if that were the case, then we'd know that the implantation of consciousness in the metal and then implanting that into a body, that originated at the very first emergence of altars. When the intelligence out there wanted to become incarnate, so in two ways, at the same time, we started to have altars being built in antiquity. That's not an accident. Not at all. And so what we're looking at, again, is an intelligence that's evolving. It's mutating, and it's evolving according to our awareness of it. But to answer your question specifically, yes. When we have altars being built, we would call it idolatry in antiquity. When those altars were being built in the Levant, suddenly we have the emergence, okay, of what we're called dream demons, who are trying to self-replicate through the wombs of women. And then we have the emergence of the implant. That was all designed to self-replicate whatever this intelligence is. Now, if you fast forward to modernity, people are going to go say, okay, well, you know what? That, you know, it doesn't really sound the same. Okay, provide your evidence. Because the evidence I've collected is pattern confirming. You know, I mean, it's not an accident that Tim Taylor is out in the New Mexico desert building altars and getting technology. You know who did that first? Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
It's inconvenient, but it's not my fault. The evidence is there. That happened in antiquity. And this is what I've been telling people lately. If our model of this intelligence is wrong, then our timeline is wrong. Yeah. It's possible that disclosure occurred in antiquity at the emergence of the first altars. And we didn't realize that because we were stuck in the materialistic, scientific, nuts and bolts model of this intelligence. And I'm sorry, not sorry. It's transcending that entirely. And I can go on and on and on down that road, but we need to reconsider some facts here in light of this information.
Well, and we actually had a listener on the YouTube that was talking about how, you know, this is very akin to basically how Freddy Krueger worked. The idea of being able to come through dreams, being able to physically affect people through dreams, being able to connect with people through that and affect them in the physical world through through a dream state. And like you said, these beings seem to be able to induce a sleep state. And almost induce a state of hypnosis, which once again, very, very similar to many abduction cases when you're talking about UFOs, when you're talking about extra biological contact, things like that. So many of these
sorts,
many of the stories just seem to parallel. And I am not one who is prone to believe, everybody, that every alien species out there is demonic in nature, is evil, is out to do us harm. I am also not one, as my audience knows, who anthropomorphizes everything to the point of, well, they must be good because we would be good. You know, I'm sorry. There's things all over the world and all over the universe that have no goodwill in mind.
Correct. And you know, it's funny when people hear me comparing the two, they hear pretty much a lot of people assume things. Nathaniel is saying that all of these are demons. I would take a step back and say, okay, what I'm suggesting, and again, is that I believe this is a singular intelligence that manifesting as different identities. It's diversifying itself. And one of my points lately is the reason where it's diversifying, because it's diversifying itself. What it's allowing us to do, number one, is to apply rules to a mass that doesn't really apply to the proto intelligence behind it. And we've seen that in tauntology over and over again, where, okay, we'll go into a malevolent haunting to investigate, and we think, okay, yeah, it's just a poltergeist. And so we apply poltergeist rules to this intelligence. And next thing you know, out of nowhere, that intelligence makes eye contact. It mutates and evolves. And now you have something far more dangerous than you originally anticipated. And when we're looking at the cognitive interfaces employed by this phenomenon, it's exactly that. I mean, when you're looking at Ted Rice, and I'm going to be on his show here next month, I believe, Alien Talk. When you look at Ted Rice and the ways that these beings were trying to groom him into certain situations to believe one thing, meanwhile, they were doing something completely different. That's not a one-off. That is not a one-off. That is far more prevalent in the field than people would like to think. And what we're realizing, at least me and my colleagues, okay, is this. When you're looking at incubi cases, it's the same phenomenon as when you're looking at, okay, abduction accounts, where when they can't really get you to cooperate. And so what they will do is they'll come out and they'll have somebody that looks like somebody you know, or looks like a former husband. This happened again to Ted Rice's grandmother. Wasn't cooperating. So, okay, yeah, it's her deceased husband emerges from the shadows. That is not an accident. Matter of fact, that is first described in the Apocrypha of John. When beings wanted to copulate with women, and so they took upon the appearances of their husbands. And so what I'm saying is the evidence for this point is so compelling that we can no longer ignore this. It's not like, okay, it's not like these are antithetical. No, the same kind of dream states, the same kind of sexual pathologies, okay, the same sourcing of secretions, all of it. I mean, and what I'm suggesting right now is, okay, if we look at the profound amount of case studies that interconnect this intelligence with the occult, then we need to reexamine our current model of ufology. Because the same entities that are now telling us they're extraterrestrial were possessing George Hunt Williamson to the point that when he went into trances, a multiplicity of voices were coming out of his body.
Yeah.
No, of course, I can secularize that and say, well, that has nothing to do with ufology. Well, it does in context. He was contacting, aliens. And so what this tells me, though, is that, and I know people are going to say, okay, well, I don't agree with that. That's okay. Look at the history.
That's what conversation is about.
Tell me that didn't happen. Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's one thing to say, okay, Nathaniel's stupid. Fine. I could be really dumb, honestly. With my ADHD, I promise you, I've done stupid things. But that doesn't mean those accounts didn't occur or those experiencers didn't have testimonies to contribute to our understanding.
That's right.
And so when you're looking at the very first contact using ufology, what are we looking at? Albert Bender building altars in his attic? Really? Huh? Contacting extraterrestrials? See, again, this, if you look at it through that lens, through the correct historicity, not something fabricated by a magazine to say, okay, yeah, this is when this erupted. No. What you look at is that these beings operated exactly like all of the other entities we've encountered through the same modus operandi, right? Ouija boards. George Hunt Williamson creating homemade Ouija boards and contacting aliens. Okay, sure. Make it make sense for me. Because, again, that would be akin to NASA putting out a probe and encountering demons and horns and hooves in space.
Yeah. Yeah.
It makes no sense.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because Lamb, Aleister Crowley's little friend, was very gray in appearance whenever you consider him. I'm trying to bring an image of him up right now. But he was an interdimensional being that was, you know, his basically almost like his spiritual guide.
Yep.
You know,
correct. And I'll tell you what, I don't know if you can pull it up now. You can look up Lamb and CE5 if you really want to get in trouble.
Ooh. Really?
Yeah, I have it on my Instagram. I have it on my Instagram. Absolutely. You can look it up. Absolutely.
Well,
and again, this is,
you know, I was very happy to hear when I had Kathleen Martin on recently, she talked about some sessions that they had where they actively went through a channeled person and were having a conversation with the Council of Eight, different extraterrestrial species, answering questions about humanity, their relationship with aliens, things like that. And I asked the question, whenever y'all had these sessions, was there a spiritual guide there? Was there a minister? She was like, yes, absolutely. Always. We took that precaution. And I thought that was very interesting. The fact that they would go through the effort to make sure to have a minister there, to talk about things and to be able to differentiate that, because yeah, that is one of my big questions with CE5 is yeah. how is that any different than playing with the spirit board? You know,
no different.
How can you confirm what is coming through is not something else? Like, I'm not saying that there are not adepts out there. I'm not saying that there are not adept spiritual channelers, adept spiritual warriors. You know, I would tend to say someone as yourself, someone as our typical guest that we pair you with, you know, the good Archbishop James Cloud that we have on. I'm sure he could differentiate between good and evil. But the average person, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. And and to have groups of people focusing on bringing something forth from the other side, and to know that, like you said, Lamb has been found in CE5. That's interesting.
Yes. Yeah, it's present with but absent from. And if you look at, again, the early contactees from even the early 50s to the early 90s, oftentimes, you know, it was almost like they were giving us numbers to call. I mean, not literally, but figuratively, allegorically, you know, like that. You know, give us a number to call, and we call the number, and something else picks up. Makes me question what was the purpose of this? I mean, you know, the skull experiment. Okay, we're going to go look and for the afterlife and document anything we can about the afterlife. And then suddenly, Mr. Blue, who was alien, you know, bulbous eyes, same, you know, all of that, he appears. So again, there's something wrong here. I mean, not too long ago, I was working with a lady who was a practitioner of CE5, had a group together, performing everything she was told to perform by people who literally have no idea what they're doing. I'm just going to say it. They don't. Because in the middle of one of her sessions, a full-bodied apparition appeared. that doesn't seem to be alien. So
if it is an interdimensional being, then it is once again using a trope that you would be familiar with in order to communicate with you.
Oh, we know that. We know that, brother. And here's what we're hearing now. Well, my guide told me and a group of people that they have to do that in order to manifest.
Yeah.
And a lot of this sounds like something that Hannibal Lecter would tell someone. Not just that, but I didn't really do what you think I did to you. You misinterpreted it.
Yeah.
Total
spiritual gaslighting.
The evidence.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's ridiculous. And that's what really gets on my nerves. Because it's like, okay, you're telling people that okay, number one, they had a hysterectomy because they manifested it. What?
Mm.
Dr. Carla Turner had a 10-year-old girl that these entities were trying to do things to, and they had to have an emergency hysterectomy. But and this is what angers me so much is because, okay, if they're negative to you, it's because you manifested it. But if they're positive, it's because they're positive.
That's what they are.
It's ludicrous. There's nothing, okay, there's nothing positive about carving occult amulets, okay, underneath the skin to the surface. There's nothing positive about that, okay? There's nothing. And so what we're dealing with, again, is, and this is where I've been at lately, is, okay, who's conjuring who here?
Mm.
Because these beings, again, when this phenomenon, okay, when it diversifies its identity, let's say, and I'm going to use a case study again, Ted Rice's grandfather appeared. Okay, that's my grandfather. So the phenomenon wants us to say, okay, because that's this person, I'm going to apply rules and behavioral patterns to that person based upon who they mean to me, right? Like, okay, if Dearon Edna is a fan of the Buffalo Bills, she's not going to be a fan of the New York Giants. But, you know, again, I know that's a very simplified way of framing it. But what it wants us to do by manifesting as something it's not, it's allowing us to believe it follows certain rules. And what is happening over and over again is when we apply all of those rules to the mask itself, it's designed for that so that when the proto-intelligence behind it transcends that mask, and that is what we're dealing with, we don't know what to do with that, my friend.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
CE5, it's going to follow our rules. Mind you, they don't even follow their own.
Here's the thing. Like, I have followed the path of esoteric. I have studied so many different spiritual paths, Nathaniel. I mean, even to the point of, you know, I own grimoires. I own, you know, and have read just about everything of Solemnic root, you know, that kind of stuff. And there are very specific things to do in order to call forth a critter and know what's happening, know the differentiation between things. And there's a lot of protection that goes on. There is a lot of setting yourself up for protection. And it's a lot more than just some white light. To protect yourself, you know?
Oh, my God. And just imagine. Just imagine. It's great. It's great.
It's
almost like, oh, my God.
I don't know. And once again, I am not a hugely religious person in my life anymore. Much more spiritual. But I will never deny that there is something else out there. There is something else that does not have our best interest at heart. There are entities that exist and live on this plane with us that they play by a different set of rules, Nathaniel. And the best example that we typically give whenever we're talking is feel free to go read the book of Job, where while God is proclaiming to all the angels how great Job is, up pops the devil in the middle of heaven. Oh, so you think he's cool, huh? Mm-hmm. You could do anything but kill him, it ended up being. You know, so that's pretty much the rule, is that they can torment, poke, prod, they can do whatever they want, aside from kill us, to gain our our consent from our end.
Yeah, it's disturbing. It's disturbing. I mean, let's look at it this way. Whatever this intelligence is, it wants us to believe, number one, that there is an afterlife. Number two, that they're recruiting people to it.
Hmm.
Think about that aspect of it. What are we dealing with here, my friend? I mean, when you have experiencers that are out of body being taught how to fly craft,
yeah,
and then they go on with their life, they're not teaching muscle memory here. Matter of fact, much of that experience wasn't even remembered until they get to a certain session with memory regression, and boom. Okay, right. And this gets back in the idea where they're also being told, we can't wait for you to join us. Huh? What? Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. And what it appears to be is that there is a phenomenon that is courting the human condition, and that it's involving people into involuntary initiations. Do this. Mm. Why am I doing it? You don't need to know. And that's unfortunate, because when these experiencers come back and they have, oh my God, I can see things, I can hear things, right? And they think that all these things, they're gifts. They think it's their gift. And when they've been told before that that's not their gift, that's the intelligence.
Mm.
We see through you. We hear things through you. And often, a lot of times, that individual is experiencing it along with that intelligence.
Yeah.
Thinking it's them.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it can lead to a lot of dissociative disorders. It can lead to a lot of other things, you know, which especially when it leads to addiction, that kind of stuff, because of shame, ridicule, because of, you know, not being able to explain to somebody else what has happened to you. The typical victim mentality that happens from anybody who has, you know, been touched, molested, gone through a traumatic experience in their life, you know, where they would rather not feel than to feel that. And the problem is that just allows things to dig in deeper. That is just more consenting into the system, when you start doing that. And I guess that's what it really comes down to. Here in the last, we've got you for about another 10 minutes. How can people who have had these experiences, Nathaniel, how can they, start to recognize them in their future? How can they actively, I guess, head this off at the pass? Is there anything that they can do, once connected to unconnect? How can people see this happening with family members, things like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, I'm trying to figure out if I should even recommend people doing memory regressions. There's a lot of people I've seen and even worked with where you do memory regression and trauma comes out, memories come out that they didn't even know existed. And then they have an even larger problem now. It's like, okay, that doesn't fit into my worldview. There's something wrong. What I can tell you is this, that outside of religious amulets, iron works. It does work. And it's not just me saying that. There are other researchers in the field that have experienced it in being employing that and having success with it. So iron first was originated, again, not just in witchera literature, but in the Levant. And it was against this intelligence, specifically, you know, the missing fetus syndrome. And so I would employ iron. If you have iron amulets, use those. But what I'm suggesting here, again, is that is this to a mask, right? Are we using all of this? You know, so, okay, the amulets work because they're demons. Okay, well, what if that too is a mask, right? What if there's something else out there and that is responsible for the inconsistency we're seeing, not just in ufology, but in demonology? Whereas where one prescription should work for all of it, it doesn't. And it's like Father Sinister of Amino, where he encounters an entity. He thinks it's a demon, throws everything he has at it. And then he looks at him and it's like, that doesn't work. If it doesn't work, we have to adjust our model. We have to start thinking deeper. We can't be like everybody else, just throw it away and ignore it because, you know, it doesn't fit into our theology. We've got to be intellectually honest.
Well, and intellectually open-minded, you know, I mean, much like NASA has said recently, we were derelict in our duties as scientists for not studying the anomaly within our data set. Quite literally, the charge of science is to figure out, well, we have this known quantity of this stray thing happened to the experiment. Ah, never mind that. Like, no, you're supposed to figure out the stray thing that happened to the experiment. I don't know. I don't think I would have passed chemistry class if I couldn't explain where the 3% remainder of solution went. Did it go to gas? Become sediment? Like, you've got to account for the lost 3%. You've got to account for the anomaly, you know, and
no matter what.
We had the same listener chime in a second ago on YouTube about the fact that even hypnosis can in and of itself be its own Ouija board. And that's why you're saying you don't even know if you recommend that anymore, because if somebody who is hypnotizing you is not, I guess, spiritually founded enough to, once again, such as yourself, such as Archbishop James Cloud or somebody else, able to recognize the difference between a possessing spirit or other spirit and the other or our subconscious mind, then they could very well be doing the exact same thing. They could very well just be prying the hole open further, so to speak.
Yeah. Right. We don't know who's conjuring who at this point.
Yeah. And that in and of itself is a disturbing and very interesting concept, because we've got about five more minutes and we need to have you on again to talk about the relation of this to the longtime stories of the Fae. Because those were the dangers of the Fae, of the fairies. And it's funny how fairies are now friendly, happy, go lucky, invite the fairies, feed the fairies. Heck no, don't feed the fairies, man. Don't build houses for them near your house. They are mischievous things that will mislead you, that when they call you into the forest, will never let you come home. Those are the stories of the Fae. So, and that's the thing, is that they would, much like a siren, which was a type of fae, call you in. So the idea that these things are, like you said, which way is the summoning happening from? Are we summoning them or are they summoning us to them?
Correct. And that will be an entire long, like a 1-hour show we can do. And I'll go through case studies. Again, when does the experience start? When they manifest to us?
Yeah.
Or they manifest us to them? When does the experience start? I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
It starts when we start building altars, not when it manifests to us. We've got the model wrong, in my opinion.
You know, it's interesting that you say it starts when you start building altars, because one of the things I have been mentioning in many paranormal groups recently and on many shows that I appear on is the idea that, are you, as a scientist, blank slating yourself as you prepare for an investigation? You should not be thinking about that property. You should not be thinking about going to that property. You should be as coldly as possible preparing gear and just thinking about a checklist of gear. Because the more you think about the property, everything else, the more you are actively charging that property, the more you are actively charging your own mind to accept, like, oh, you know, I heard about this haunting. I heard about this. Like, you are now setting up tropes in your own mind, which even scientifically may bias you on the way there. It's quite literally having the conversation on the way to the table. You're putting mortar and brick down before you ever get to the conversation of the investigation.
Correct.
You know, but it's also the fact of, are you opening that door to something else?
Right. That's one thing that I've been trying to do lately, is not hold myself to one single understanding of this intelligence in terms of, okay, are they demons or aliens or what are they? Because I don't want to go into an investigation and the phenomenon do what it does best, wear pieces of me as a cognitive interface. And there, of course, I'll agree with it. Why? Because that's what I think anyway.
Yeah.
And it's, right? And that terrifies me. I'm like, I don't want to do that. So well, I'm kind of open myself up a bit.
Well, and it's interesting that you keep referring to their technology, the technology of being able to short circuit us, the technology of being able to, as the same listener just said, summon us in order to summon them. You know, it's like they're it's no different than a programmer that put a back door into his program to be able to always have access in the software.
It's the illusion of control, my friend. The illusion of control. This is what the Collins elite realized, is that in their research, they realized, oh my God. Yeah, the phenomenon will allow us to believe we're in control.
Yeah.
And this is the framework that Nick Redfern quoted. It's funny. They allowed us to assume we have control.
That's right.
And then once we got into the depths of the darkness, suddenly there's a proto-intelligence there. Here you go.
Yeah.
Here you go. And now you're in the presence of something you cannot quantify.
Yeah.
You cannot define. In all of the rules you thought it followed, in all the rules you followed to get to it, doesn't matter. This in of itself is more alien than alien.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got to do another show, man.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and I was going to say, it is unfortunately time for us to wrap this part of the conversation, but let everybody know where they can go to follow you. Let everybody know where they can go to keep up with everything that is Nathaniel Gillis, because you are trying to get out to more conferences. You are trying to get out to more shows, things like that, to be able to spread the word of this. It is, I think, a phenomenal realm of study. And something that we need to pay more attention to, because like I said, even the good Professor Emeritus was like, there's something else there, Chris.
There's something else there.
So,
and I'm going to pull up my show schedule if I can find it. I'm booked out. I mean, pretty much the month. So my next show is, what's the date today, brother? 12th. All right. Tomorrow, I'm with Truth and Shadows.
Ooh.
And then, the 1st, April 1st, I'm at Through the Glass Darkly. And I'm booked out till the 12th of April.
Awesome.
And I like that. You know?
That's great. Yeah, that's so great. Out there spreading the word, out there spreading the knowledge and getting this out to more people. I always love our conversations on air and off air.
Likewise, brother.
Let's get you on again soon to talk about that idea of the, maybe we can get you on with Nikki Folsom. That would be a cool double shot because she does a lot of work into the Fae. And the concept of the Fae. And that, once again, that's another one that people have just forgotten. People have just forgotten what the actual history is. So you take care of yourself, my friend. I'll be sharing links, all that kind of good stuff. Godspeed in all the work. Man, absolutely. It is always great talking with Nathaniel Gillis. I mean, he is one of the most amazing individuals out there. His realm of knowledge in this is vast and huge. And I cannot, once again, I am not one who believes that every alien experience, every abduction, everything like that is demonic in nature. And I am not here to say that every demonic in nature experience is alien. I think that they are vastly different, much like I think that there is an actual pre-humanoid hominid walking the forests of North America and beyond. But there is also something else that is hijacking the tropes in our mind where we say, man, it'd be cool to see a Bigfoot. And it goes, okay, well, there's my invitation in. Are we opening the window to those things with our acceptance of ideas? Are we opening it to them whenever we prepare ourselves for an investigation, whenever we start talking about these things before we go out to experience them? So something to keep in mind, everybody. When we come back from commercial break, we will be joined by the head of Southern California MUFON, as well as one of the founding members of the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, our good friend Earl Grey will be on to talk about the recent Arrow document release, the first volume of the historic, how the U.S. government has looked into UFOs, looked into crash retrieval, things like that. We'll get into that document right after this. Before we let you go, make sure to remember you can always stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to find all of the episodes. That's where you can go to find all of the videos from our guests. You can find all of their video channels embedded right there as well. Oh, my golly. There we go. So, yeah, like you can follow Nathaniel. You can follow 5x5 News. You can follow all of our guests right there on our video channel, CuriousRealm.com/videos. The Knowledge Vault, CuriousRealm.com/knowledge, gives you all of the declassified government documents, UFO, paranormal things, all that. Make sure to like, follow, subscribe, share. When we come back from this commercial break, everybody, we will be talking with Earl Grey about the recent Arrow release right after this. Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for hanging out through that short commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my favorite CBD oil out there. I'm not just saying that. I used True Hemp Science for about a good year before I approached them for a sponsorship. I was prescribed CBD by my doctor for my travel anxiety and searched all over the country as I traveled, going to different dispensaries, trying different product, and they were the only ones I found with actual terpene profiles to their product. It is all made in a spigyric alchemical process. Every part of the plant is used, everything from the seeds to the stems to the roots to the leaves, everything, including the buds of the CBD plant. And I'm telling you, folks, it is absolutely awesome. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHemScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles on your way out the door as well. Our guest in this segment is our good friend and head of Southern California, MUFON. I think he's a little irate because of the recent Arrow announcement and document that we'll be talking about at the beginning of his segment. But welcome back to the show, Earl Grey Anderson. How you doing, buddy?
Doing really good. How are you doing there, Chris?
I'm doing okay, man.
That's quite the introduction. Wow. Might as well just go now.
I gotta go. There, you know. Thanks for letting me on, guys. I gotta go.
No, better not do that.
Well, and honestly, the new host of the MUFON podcast. So the new official voice of MUFON out there in the ether. Welcome to the world of podcasting. I don't think they dragged you kicking and screaming, but it was definitely an awesome invitation to hear that you got. So welcome to that, and welcome to that world. I can't wait to work with you guys at the upcoming symposium in Dallas.
My co-host, is one of my dearest friends, and we're both mentees of Kathleen Martin, both Sev and myself.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, and it's really awesome and honoring that you guys were asked to take that on. And it's kind of like I was talking to my wife today, because it's funny. I belong to a lot of associations, and I akin some of them sometimes, Earl, to whenever I walk into a Knights of Columbus meeting on occasion, and it's like I don't pay for beer. Because everybody's like, oh, look at the young buck, man. Make sure and buy him a beer so he sticks around. It's like, young buck, I'm 50. I don't know if I'm the demo that you want to be courting for the next 20 years, So the fact that you guys are hosting this podcast, are moving things into that social realm, into that social media realm, to reach a younger audience, to get a younger audience interested in the scientific process of UFO UAP study, as well as the scientific process of dealing with experiencers. And that's something that I don't think that a lot of people understand that MUFON has, is the experiencer resource team. The idea of dealing with people who have had close contact, people who have had abduction experience, people who have had what amounts to one of the most traumatic experiences of their life, and literally very few support groups. It's not like you're going to find a support group at the local library or annex necessarily. So,
Yeah. There was a need for this. And Kathleen Martin saw this. Dr. George Medich, our fearless leader, he saw the need for a support system for those who have had ET contact. Because contact episodes, they kind of run the gamut. I mean, for some people, it's all Space Brothers and it's beautiful and high vibrations from going out the gate. But for myself, it was traumatic. I asked for it, literally. I wanted to, you know, I was a new field investigator at MUFON. This was like around 8 years ago when it happened. I was kind of doing the nuts and bolts stuff at MUFON. I was good at it, still am, you know. I still love to get plain old UFO cases that nothing like. I mean, come on. There's no such thing as a plain old UFO. They're all extraordinary and
absolutely.
Yes. But when I had my experience, I didn't know where to go. I contacted Peter Robbins, and he was helpful. You know, Peter had worked with Bud Hopkins, and I knew this much back in those days. But I finally, you know, we had the ERT back then and kind of just sort of a rarefied form back in those days. There were just a few people that were working on the team. We were called the experiencer, research team. And after a while we figured out, you know, that's not really the correct title. We can keep the acronym ERT, but we're more of a resource. We're there to help these folks get over the speed bump of ontological shock that everybody goes through when their world is turned upside down by meeting entities face to face. It changes person and it changes your outlook on everything.
Yep.
And without the correct support and knowing that you're not alone in this, that many, many people have gone through the same thing. Yeah. You're just kind of out there floating aimlessly, you know, no gravatics available. And some people wind up kind of stuck at that point. It can make you paranoid, afraid. It's traumatic.
It can lead to a lot of issues, Earl. It can lead to issues of addiction. It can lead to issues of isolation. It can lead to issues of depression, anxiety, all kinds of stuff. And
ridicule.
You know, absolutely. And even self-shame.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're hiding something that you don't really know if you should hide, but who really understands?
Yes.
You know, and that's just it. Trying to find resources to support people who have been through that can be hard, you know.
Yeah, we have those. And we have support groups. I have access to vetted hypnotherapists that are not part of MUFON, mind you. I mean, we have to be careful about kind of separating ourselves from those resources, because MUFON is not in the business of healthcare or psychological care.
That's right.
But we can certainly give somebody a list of people that have been vetted and checked out and make sure that they're not going to be exploited or led. You know, I mean, if you don't know how to do hypnotic regression properly with an abductee or a visitee, it can you can mislead their hypnotic regression session and put it, implant false memories. And all that stuff is very, very important to us, especially to me. I come from a healthcare, you know, I was a nurse for 40 years, happily retired now. I'm a full-time ufologist, which I love. But that's what the ERT is there for. And I'm proud to be an executive member, as well as SevTalk. She is as well. And Kathleen kind of got that ball rolling years ago. And we both, Sev and I, feel this great gratitude in our hearts for Kathleen and for what we get to do.
Yeah.
It's a blessing. It's an honor. And we're there to help people. I know that when I was on Ancient Aliens, you know, I was talking with the producer and I was telling him about the ERT. And he said, "Oh, wait a minute. I thought MUFON was just about research, but you're telling me, it sounds like MUFON actually has a heart." And I said, yes.
A beating, throbbing heart.
the beating heart of ufology is that it's not just nuts and bolts craft, although they're physical, and but there's also, you have to think, you know, the most important thing is who is flying these craft of mystery, and there's an interaction that takes place. It's an interactive phenomenon.
Well, and the vested interest of people involved in it. And, you know, that is one of the reasons why I'm and believe me, folks, it's no commercial for MUFON whenever I have them on. I have them on because I support their endeavors. I support their endeavors personally. I'm a lifetime member of MUFON. I'm looking into taking the field investigator training, so that I can contribute to my local area in such a way, because I think I have a different analytical way of looking at things. And being able to, and a certain realm of knowledge about, especially astronomy, things like that, that I do in my backyard regularly, regular nighttime observations, that kind of stuff. So, but it's the fact for me that they're one of the only organizations out there that you will find that, is not driven by money. Money is there, but it's not like you as a state director take a salary from MUFON or get a bonus. Like the main head of MUFON draws a salary. Some of the IT folks who manage servers and stuff like that and do regular everyday heavy lifting pull a salary. But there's not a field investigator out there that gets paid to bury cases or not look at cases. There's not a state director out there that's getting a Christmas bonus to, you know, pull a hard line or something like that. You know,
the work is the reward. What you find out, what you learn, and being able to help others, you know, is just,
that's it.
You know, it's important to me as a person, you know, and doing that as a nurse for many years. And I feel like I'm still a caregiver, and that is a blessing. I love that.
Well, absolutely. And you know, I wanted to make that preface before we get going, because of course, MUFON was a large contributor to the first panels, the first round of questions that happened, which all led to the founding of Aero. You know, and the fact of an all domain anomaly reconnaissance office, you know, or research office. So the fact that this exists, the fact that, you know, y'all were part and parcel at the beginning of this starting, does not mean that y'all necessarily stand with the decisions that have been made, or that, even the recent document which came out, you know, there's a lot in there, and there's a lot that was kind of expected. You know, I have said and held on this show for a long time that big D disclosure, anything like that, is going to have to happen through a legal hammer means. You know, like nobody's going to have their arm twisted enough, I don't think, to pull out a piece of wreckage and like Houdini, you know, like,
I think it's been offered. Houdini a tablecloth off.
You know, oh, I'm sure that people want it to. I know people want it to happen. I want it to happen. I'd love nothing more than for them to, like, okay, everybody, here we go. Bring out a Queen Mary, like from the back of a hotel, you know, from catering, and like, oh, well, here's the tube with the body in it, you know, bubbles going and everything. Like, that would be awesome. But it's not in anybody's vested financial interest. You aren't going to get Congress to unplug any more money faucets by doing that, by continuing, like you were saying earlier, that doctrine of fear. Doctrine of there's something in our skies and we need superiority. That's how you untie purse strings.
How did you feel after you had read the Aero document that just came out?
You know, personally, once again, disheartened but not surprised,
Earl.
And just so you know, everybody, the document that we're referring to is, of course, available at curiousrealm.com/knowledge. Just head on over to our declassified program section. And it's the top one right there, the 2024 Aero Historical Record Report, which actively goes through. This is fully unredacted. It goes through projects like, you know, Project Saucer, the first one that they list, like programs since 1945. Since 1945, since 2 years before Roswell, our government and military at least had an active interest in what these things were.
Yep. Yep. You know, I mean, here's my thoughts about
please,
it.
Please.
You have to pardon me. I'm getting over that flu, so I've been grabbing my handkerchief a little bit. It just came down to a little bit of a runny nose.
You're good.
You know, my mom, you know her story, that she worked in officialdom back in the 1950s. She was working for Howard Hughes. She claimed to that she worked in an underground city, middle of the desert somewhere. She couldn't tell me that much because, of course, she signed NDAs and she kept her security clearances till the day that she died. She wound up working as a private in the private sector as a headhunter for the aerospace companies like Lockheed, Boeing and Northrop and et cetera. You know, it's the litany that you hear David Grush mentioning, you know, about people that have materials. And my mom told me back after I took her to see the film Star Wars, it got her talking a little bit. Nothing could usually get her talking about it. It was frustrating, but for some reason that film did. And, you know, she talked about, she said that Star Wars is not far-fetched, son. All the different beings, the different spacecraft, all that. It's just like that out there. And we already know this. We're not alone. But they're never, ever going to tell the public. And we'd had a similar conversation back when I was 5 years old, for God's sake. At age 19, I think I was 1977. Yeah, I was 19. I was old enough to ask her, well, why the hell not? Why wouldn't they tell the public? This is like one of those very, very important core questions that every human has. Is there a God? What happens when I die? You know, are we alone in the universe?
Yeah.
And she told me in 1977, she said, they will never, ever tell the public. They're afraid that people will react badly. And then she mentioned the War of the Worlds radio broadcast and how people had barricaded themselves up. And she mentioned world religions, that it could affect those and fortunes. And that's kind of how she left it. And when she said this to me, it sounded like she was reiterating something that she had been told officially. And now I've heard the same spiel from quite a few people that are, you know, in aerospace and in positions of authority out there. They're still using that same kind of meme of we're afraid of how the public will react. We're afraid that, you know, it'll disrupt the, you know, fortunes and the balance of things. And I don't quite believe that. I think that we are probably absolutely more ready for this information than we ever have been. That's my feeling. But anyway, I didn't really expect them to bring this out like total disclosure just because my mom pretty much she was so emphatic when she told me this. My feeling was, well, maybe something's changed since 1977, but apparently not. You know, I think that the toothpaste was out of the tube and now they're doing their very best trying to get that back in the tube.
Yeah.
Good luck. It's a mess no matter how you look at it. I wouldn't want to be one of those guys.
Yeah. And I was highlighting a little bit of the document talking about, you know, the program Kona Blue, which supposedly existed. And, you know, they go into some detail about some programs that have been talked about in communities for a long time. You know, and even the idea here of Kona Blue, you know, let me bring that back up. But Kona Blue traces its origins back to the DIA and a supposed special appropriation executed by its primary contractor, a private sector organization. And it goes on to talk about how their job was to, you know, allegedly collect off-world biologics. It is critical to note that no extraterrestrial craft or bodies were ever collected. This material was only assumed to exist by Kona Blue advocates and its anticipated contract performers. This was the same assumption made by those same individuals involved with the OSAP and ATIP programs. But the important thing is that apparently it existed. So, So somebody at least got far enough to be like, well, you know, we should really have a branch that like collects this stuff and gets ready to collect. And it's like, all right, well, it kind of seems like this farcical idea was actually there, you know, and actually in place. And
well, we've all heard stories from people that have, you know, apparently gone out on you know, crash retrievals and stuff like that. Yeah. Battelle Institute, they received their materials from somewhere. And yeah, I've spoken with people like Irina Scott and other, you know, Irina actually worked for Battelle. And that was the buzz way, way back then, that they had crash materials that supposedly came from the Roswell incident. I mean, when I read the Arrow report, I wasn't surprised, but I thought that it was disingenuous. It was disappointing. You know, I was asked to write a article for Outer Limits magazine about it. And usually, you know, I write a regular column there called The Gray Files, and it's just usually my case work, you know, and my best cases, I redact names and all that. And I was authorized by MUFON headquarters that I could do this about 5-6 years ago. This is the first time I've ever diverted from my just cases, because it was such an important paper. It was so disappointing. And I sent my original ideas to Chris Evers. Mm. Who is he's the publisher of Outer Limits, and he said, Earl, you need to sleep on this a little bit, get your anger back in control, and then redo this, because I don't want litigation to happen.
Yeah,
I understand. You know, I mean, I mean, right off, you know, my initial title for the paper was the document of disingenuousness, and that is still how I feel. It's the Grudge Report Mach 2. You would think and you would hope that since the 77 years since Roswell, that, you know, we've learned something, and that the public has been saturated with this subject for so long, with Spielberg films and now everything that's on television. You know, you turn on the Oscars and like there are all these UFO related commercials for soda pop or what have you. Yeah. I mean, I think the public is ready. They're at least ready for small D disclosure, for, you know, for somebody to say, these people aren't crazy. This is pilots, doctors, military, commercial pilots, the best, the creme la creme of people that have reported having encounters with these things. And they're not, you know, ridicule isn't a part of the scientific method.
Yeah.
But they still seem to be using ridicule, you know, people like Nick West and should I name names, you know, I don't care, you know, it's just like the same old, you know, it used to be Carl Sagan. And of course, the Condon Report, our mutual friend, Greg Bishop, he put out the Ufology Tarot, and he gave the devil card to Carl Sagan and to Ed Condon, you know, and it shows like instead of a upside down pentagram behind them, they have the wings of the F-117 back there, you know, or F-115. I mean, it was just it's just the same old argument and spiel, and I think that we're ready for more than that. And I don't think it's going to ruin anybody's lunch, much less their lives. The Catholic Church is very smart. They seem to be embracing the phenomenon. Unfortunately, there's a lot of, you know, religious people that are, you know, equating the phenomenon with demonology and stuff like that, which is very sad. It's kind of predictable, but
it to me shows the phenomenon, because one of the things that we talk about regularly on the show is the phenomenon of cognitive dissonance. And the idea that your brain will not accept something sometimes, despite the evidence that builds, that is contrary to its actual belief or foundational belief. Mm. There's that mixed societally with the want of confirmation, and be it a want of confirmation of, here I am with a group of like-minded individuals. You know, here I am in a church of people that all believe the same thing, what have you. And the dangerous thing comes when those two things mix.
Yeah.
When you get an enemy of enlightenment. Inside or outside of a church wall, though, whenever you get a mind that, A, is immovable and will not accept new information, despite evidence to the contrary, and will firmly continue to believe what has been proven to be wrong to them, you know, and then you mix that even with just the clogged filter and the idea. I mean, good God, man, I got AI art going on over my shoulder. There's some of that that looks so convincing that I have done that. It's like I could put it in a group and be like, look at this image that I got. I mean, some of them are images.
We're watching you, Chris.
but in all sincerity, you know, and that's the thing, though, is that we have to be willing to step back. As a society, we have to be willing to step back. As a society, we have to be willing to understand that we have this want and need sometimes so much for that want of confirmation that we psychologically humanize. It's called anthropomorphizing. And it's a problem that I know I had in college whenever I was studying abnormal psychology. And we were going out and studying the gorillas at the zoo and studying gorilla behavior, things like that. My professor consistently had to tell me, stop anthropomorphizing, Chris. You have no idea why that gorilla picked up the stick. Just write down that he picked up the stick and what time he did it, how long he held it. That's it. That's the scientific observation. To take it anywhere beyond that is hearsay and conjecture. It may be your opinion, but it's not science.
Right.
You've anthropomorphized. And we tend to do that with aliens. We tend to think that, you know, something that travels that far and can do that, you know, like that if we got that way as a society, that we would be all loving and understanding and, you know, not have a need for want or money or treasure or personal belongings or ego. I choose to ascribe a little bit more to the realistic Stephen Hawking point of view where, you know, maybe as we shoot something to Europa, we shouldn't leave instructions.
How to get here. Yeah. I get that.
Maybe stop leaving direct maps. Right? Maybe, you know, because that's anthropomorphizing. You are assuming the fact that whatever finds that has your best interest at heart.
Or the worst interest. That's the other thing. I mean, we look at aliens as a threat because we're a threat. Well, right. I mean, we look at what we've done to, you know, the Aboriginals in Australia, to the tribes in the Mesoamericas,
Amazon,
Yes, and then we turn that around and we misinterpret that as well, they must have those same goals. Well, and, look, we did that. And that's not necessarily true at all.
Well,
anthropomorphism.
We filter all of it through our lens of experience. So those who are seeing it as demonic, you know, I'd love to fault them, Earl. I more pray for their smaller understanding. You know, and almost myopic understanding of something instead of a wider panoply point of view, which you kind of need a forest and the trees situation.
Yes.
Not just like, nope, that's a forest. Yeah, but there's so many different types of trees. Nope, just a forest. Is it deciduous or is it conifer? Nope, it's a forest. You know, there's so many different types and you have to be willing to accept that. And, you know, God bless them for not being able to see it from outside of the walls of a Wednesday service. You know,
I look
at it.
I am a Christian.
Same.
Former Catholic seminarian. You know, one time, like you, I took pre-seminary classes I was young, and knowing that we're not alone and knowing that there's other, you know, intelligent beings out there like us has not destroyed my belief in Christianity. No. I've had to evolve certain areas of my Christianity. But it still comes down to, you know, the kingdom of God being revealed in your actions, in your heart. Basileia is the Greek term for kingdom. It doesn't mean so much a physical place, like here's the border and here's the kingdom. It means the reign of, like the British Commonwealth. You know, it's the influence and the reign. And you can see that in anybody, I think, that is of good heart and it is following those Christian precepts, and I will say it's made me a better person. It's made me, I think, a better Christian to know that God that it's not a human centric universe. Well, that we're not the end all of what creation is, or the crown of creation.
Well, and it's interesting to me how to take this idea and bring it back to the document that we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me to see programs that are funded, to see these things, to see the argument even for having the programs, but that once again, the only reason why purse strings are untied is because there's a danger involved. Mm-hmm. Not because there's exploratory nature that needs to happen. More money for science to explore this more. We need more money to poke and prod it so that we can find the weaknesses and make sure that we are strengthened against it and that we have something to take it down. You know, and it's
what interesting. What do we pay the DOD to do?
That's what we pay him for. Yeah,
weaponization of, you know, foreign technology, so that 110. Nobody gets the, you know, the upper hand on us, right?
Yeah.
So they're technically doing the right job, but I think that they're the wrong gatekeepers for this whole realm, this whole phenomenon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and
they should be in there. I mean, you know, there could be certain threats and certain things that. But that shouldn't be the all in all, and that shouldn't be the deciding who gets to know that we are not alone or not.
And like I said on the show I was on Saturday night, Oral, you know, you have to remember that once again, the data that they are drawing from, specifically Arrow, not the other thing, because who knows if Arrow actively has access to everything that they had access to in Project Grudge. You know, most of that once gone probably exists within whatever unredacted Project Grudge document there is. And the rest of it was probably put into berm bags years ago and gotten rid of. Sadly, you know, but the original photos, things like that, doubtful that Arrow got to ever look at them. Or anything like that. What they said, though, was that out of the things that we got to examine, you know, And that's what we have to remember, is that for a long, long time before Arrow, there wasn't a government MUFON where there was a 50-year standardized process for taking in a report. There wasn't a government NICAP where there was a 35-plus-year standardized process for taking in a report. If you came in with a report, you were either fired, buried, or reassigned. Mm. You were discouraged from giving a report. You were not discouraged as a Delta Airlines pilot to say what you saw on your flight from Alaska to Hawaii. You were not encouraged to come forward with that. You know, that it's not something that was common. So the fact that they are having to go through, yes, data from you guys, new data, the fact that there is now finally a system that people are like, thumb and a half up, accepted to go and go do it. You know, like, it's not fully two thumbs up from Arrow yet, but the fact is there is now a unified process. So, their data field to look at was narrow to begin with. I can firmly understand why they would say what they would say with what they were given and with what they had to look at, you know, because even anything relating to Malmstrom and the shutdown or anything like that, they're
going to bring that up.
Far long gone. Far long gone.
Apparently all the documents have been destroyed. And
yeah,
but it's very, very frustrating, you know, being friends with both Robert Salas and David Schindley. You know, mm-hmm. The way synchronicity works for me, I'd been trying to get a hold of David for quite a while, a few years. And the guy kind of keeps to himself. And I understand that.
Me too.
Very highly venerated, the commander of the Minot Air Force Base. And he went through the exact same thing that Robert Salas's base did when Robert was in the capsule at Malmstrom the year before. You know, a UFO and, you know, incursion. They had the incursion on the base. It was hovering over the nuclear ICBM missile capsule that, you know, had oxygen pumped down to it, computer system, radio system. And the same thing happened both times, that there was an incursion of a UFO hovered over the base. It did something very targeted to 10 of the missiles at Malmstrom. The same thing happened at Minot. It did not affect the radio. It did not affect their computer systems. It didn't affect the oxygen. They had O2 pumped down there. It was an underground facility. So it wasn't like an EMP, like an electromagnetic pulse. It was targeted at the missiles. It destroyed the launch systems and took them offline. They had to fix them. It wasn't like they could just flip a switch and they were back on. I know that both Robert Salas and David Schindley, I have the written statements that both of them provided for the Arrow meetings and for Congress. They both gave very detailed testimonies about exactly what happened, who was there, and then I'm reading the Arrow final report that came out after, you know, Kirkpatrick left the room like Elvis left the building. You know,
my job here is done.
Yeah. But it was almost like somebody leaving a crime scene. You know, I mean, he put out this document and he is gone. And but it said that every single thing that was presented to him could have been explained in some prosaic way by some natural phenomenon. I'd like to know what natural phenomena hangs over your military base, the most secure, you know, we're talking the heart of the Cold War, turns off specifically the missiles that are there, you know, in the launch bays, leaves everything else alone. You know, it wasn't an attack.
Let you chat about it.
Harming humans, you know, it was just made a very clear message known, and then they were gone. And what the heck? Natural prosaic phenomenon could do something like that. I would love to know it. I'd love to be able to question Kirkpatrick about this.
In his previous report, before announcing his upcoming retirement, because this was the one released on the way out the door. But in his previous report, and even in his previous testimony, said there is a good 5%, 3 to 5 percentile of what we have been provided that we cannot explain. It is not our technology. It is not known technology of our enemy or adversaries.
But that's not what the public is seeing. The public is seeing nothing to see here, folks. Move along.
These guys are all crazy, making stuff up, or misidentifying stuff. Well, and that's just it. You know, is the 3 to 5% anomaly. I've said it numerous times. I firmly believe most of what people are seeing or witnessing are probably some sort of test craft. Something like that, something man-made, what have you, that is hush-hush technology. I mean, we have numerous bases here in Texas that test stuff like that, you know. But where did that technology originally come from? There is a good cadre. Well, you know, whether or not it was reverse engineered, who knows? You know, that's another story in and of itself, because, yeah, we would, you know, have to prove the extraterrestrial conundrum to begin with. And I think once we are at least able to prove either that or, you know, figuring out 1% of the 5% anomaly, you know, and proving that, Earl, will get us worlds closer.
Yes.
Because I
agree with the percentage that that 5 to 10% is what we kind of find. That was Dr. J. Allen Hynek's rule of thumb as well. We find that here as well. We had kind of a better year last year where it seemed to be about 10% were unexplainable. But, you know, people see SpaceX, they see Venus, they see, personal drones on flash mode. The best sightings, they can't be explained in any way like that.
Yeah.
And sure, I'm sure that we have secret programs. I know we have secret programs.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But there's billions
released to them in every NDAA every year. It's like they say it like, here's the black budget. They don't even call it anything else. I guess they call it SAPs, like special access programs.
Well, you have to look at Ben Rich. Way back in 1990, you know the story, speaking at UCLA, and he said, everything that you've seen on Star Trek and Star Wars, we can do and even better, but the public will never see it because it's all hidden in the black budget projects.
That's right.
He said UFO, it was an acronym for unfunded objectives or something like that. But, you know, I mean, so we know that we've got our own UFOs. Where that technology came from, of course, there was quite a strange boom that happened after 1945, after 47. Things seem to ramp up. I've read, of course, the day after Roswell and Don Schmidt and Gary and all those guys. I think they've done a magnificent job of uncovering things. I mean, Denise Marcel, for God's sake, she was one of our local field investigators for a while, a state section director, still in touch with Denise, lovely woman. And, you know, for them, it's a personal thing. They feel like their father was ridiculed purposely and that he didn't sign up for that. This was a man who was, you know, highly regarded and honored and in medals and the whole deal. And they had him pose with that just open package with a weather balloon. And the expression on his face is pretty obvious. It's like, you got to be kidding me. You're going to make me do this.
Yeah.
It's just I feel like there's so many people that should be honored and could be honored. And on the level of like Neil Armstrong for stepping on the moon, there were the early, the people that early on this adventure that we're seeing with visitations and craft and what's going on. But yet these people are treated like they're crazy or making things up. And again, ridicule is not a part of science. Dr. Hynek originally said that's not part of the scientific method. And yet they seem to treat it that way.
And, it's been interesting to see NASA's ramped up involvement with things. I've been very impressed by that. I've been very happy with it. I've liked the last few conferences they did, especially the first one where they did all the trigonometry on screen with the Go Fast video.
Yeah.
that was fantastic, because that was one that myself, I had talked with Mike Turber about that on air numerous times, and about how it's just off. And to hear them say that, like, no, the charge of science is to look into the anomaly, not to keep looking at the known quantitative. Yes, we have to scientifically back each other's work. We have to independently prove theorems and hypotheses, things like that. But when an anomaly pops up and continues to pop up, and we are not adding that to a part of the datum set and adding that to the set of data, we as a scientist are not doing our job.
No, we're not doing our due diligence to the scientific community. Yeah. And it's frustrating. It is.
Yeah.
Now, I find there's more openness now in the Absolutely. Scientific community. People like Michio Kaku and others seem to be very, very much on board.
Michio's been out there for a while. I remember hearing him on Coast to Coast a good 20 years ago. He always had the equation in his head that there's no reason there shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if within the next 20 or 30 years something happens, and it's great. And I think a lot of that, yes, does have to do with the Rubik's Cube reshuffling of letters and changing things from UFO to UAP, because there is a Kleenex mentality when it comes to things. There are 101 different types of facial and personal tissues out there, folks. 90% of the time when you sneeze, someone says, do you need a Kleenex?
Kleenex.
Not do you need a facial tissue. Not do you need a tissue with lotion or aloe? And that's just it. It's all been thrown into a Kleenex box. It's all been thrown into a catch-all bin.
And we're looking at various phenomena, and I've always felt that I think that there's validity to the interdimensional hypothesis, the interstellar hypothesis, the us from the future hypothesis, the hypothesis that perhaps there's another intelligence that just grew up alongside of us on Earth and is hidden underwater forever. I mean, all those things, it doesn't have to be just one. I don't think that just one of those hypotheses covers everything that we see and that comes in just personal reports from people.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it gets lumped into the UFO. And I love the UFO.
Same.
My friend Greg Bishop, he says that every once in a while. He says, Earl, you love the UFO, like and he's right.
The idea of it.
The whole idea, the whole everything around it. I do love that. I don't understand it. I'm not going to tell you where it's coming from and tell you this is definitive.
Yeah.
I have my hypotheses as well, but that doesn't mean that they're right.
To bring it back to the beginning of the conversation, Earl, you gladly state this is my hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I think. Not this is what
this
is.
This is what, yeah.
You know, like that's...
That would be a lie.
Because that's not even the job of science. Science can't even say what is.
Mm-mm.
Like, the prime example is what we reference probably at least once a show. The fact that we are, by all ninth grade science, 90% empty space. So let your noodle keep cooking on that one, folks. The fact that, like... You are only 10% solid. The rest of you is totally empty space. So how is your brain existent? How is it like that means that your atoms physically have to be not only conscious, but consciously cooperating to create a consciousness.
Like, love it.
That'll bake your noodle all day. But that's actual
science.
That's the
stuff that makes me dance. That's the stuff that makes me joyful. It's how strange the universe is.
That's science.
It is a curious realm.
It is. It is.
Yes, it is.
And that science is proven over and over again. You know, even the idea of quantum entanglement winning the Nobel Prize.
At a distance.
It quite literally sets forth the proof for so many things. So many things. Like the one psychical science of or psychical research out there that is scientifically proven in lab over and over again is remote viewing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like heck statistically yeah. proven, shown.
And good old Ingo Swann.
You want to know how it happens? Quantum entanglement. The fact that there are we actually
connected.
Here? Yeah, it's wild. It's interesting. So, man, it's always great talking with you, Earl. We have about 8-9 minutes left here in the show, wrapping things up with this document, with the latest announcement, because this is volume one. This is volume one. That's my favorite part. Just so you know, folks, there's apparently more of this 63-page read. 63 pages. I know people's like senior theses that were longer than that and had a longer table of contents than what this thing does.
Yeah. It was not hard to get through.
It wasn't. It was about an hour read, something like that, you know, to take your time reading it. I sped read through it the first time because I got it and it was like, whoa, I was on a show about it shortly after. So, but yeah, volume one. So we can apparently expect more from this funded effort. The one plus side, though, Earl, is that it does go through on quite a few things that have been out in communities for a long time that are, well, let's just say hearsay and conjecture.
Yeah.
Programs that are possibly hearsay and conjecture.
And now we know they weren't.
It does confirm that a few of them were not hearsay and conjecture, and a few of them were fully hearsay and conjecture.
I don't see Project Serpo in there or anything like that. Maybe that'll be in volume two, right?
It could be. But there is a pretty good listing of programs that they go through here. You know, it's pretty interesting to go through and just see all of the programs since 1945 that have looked into this. And there's nary a year that didn't have a program where it didn't span over a decade or they didn't cross over each other and one morph into the other or something like that. So once again, this has been a continued study of this topic by our government. It's not something that, once again, that they are questioning the existence of.
Yes. And that's good. I mean, at least they're being honest about that.
Yeah. And they haven't shut Arrow down.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who founded it left, which, you know, considering it being a maybe 3 year old program, maybe 4 years old, because maybe they were working on it for a year or so before they ever announced it, probably. But with that in mind, it is interesting to see somebody who came together, formed this, got the infrastructure up, running, got the wheels grease, and is now dusting his hands instead of doing the typical government thing, which is, let me dig myself in real good here and kick some dirt around and make sure I'm nested in for decades.
Yeah.
You know, which is how programs end up burying things. That is how programs end up having things change as they move along. Being able to keep that leadership fresh and new, I think, may be something very important to keeping things moving within that office, instead of it becoming another entrenched mire of information.
I guess we'll see. Yeah. You know,
I'm a hopeful guy, though. One of my dear friends,
Stephen Bassett.
Yeah.
You know, he's very, very. I mean, the man is
I bet,
like,
he's up in arms right now.
Yes, he was very angry. He was angrier than I was. But, I'll you bet. Know, somehow or another, Steve always is able to put a good face on stuff.
That's it.
He has a brave face he puts on.
That's it.
And he expects more than just what we just recently received. And
yeah.
And I love Steve, and I love the way that he thinks. Danny Sheehan, who's one of his colleagues, I couldn't have more respect for anybody than for him. And you know, with the work that he's done, even, you know, researching the JFK incident and things like that,
yep.
You know, the Iran-Contra thing was his. So we've got good people working yeah. on it. We've got good people poking at this and trying to get this out. And I belong to the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance.
Yep.
This man reads my mind, folks. I swear, Chris and I separated at birth, I think, because I was just going to mention this group. And if you go to our website,
yep.
You can see what we're trying to do. It's a .org. We are it's official that you can donate now. We are a
awesome official, yes, 501c3.
Yes, exactly. And there's some very impressive people that are involved in this group. We're trying to yeah. get more accurate information out to Hollywood, because everything seems to be, you know, alien,
paradigm driven
invasion and this and that. And that's not what we are finding, ufology. There's no invasions going on. There's no, you know, aliens busting out of people's chest cavities. It's very yes. different than, you know, yes. the fear based stuff that Hollywood, you know, makes their, I mean, it brings in money because people like to be spooked.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we need more accurate descriptions of ETs and in contact, and the way that the reality is.
Well, and we need the main thing, Earl, is helping younger generations understand with an open mind what to do.
Yes.
You know, movies like Arrival. We're sure there's a little bit of fear and trepidation involved in there. But the idea of, wait a minute, how do we communicate with them?
Yeah.
You know,
brilliant film.
Yeah.
And MUFON was invited to the premiere. Absolutely. I had the pleasure of going to the cool. red carpet event for
cool.
that film.
And that's just it, though. Representing the other side of things, because even the news has lost that. You no longer get the Edward R. Murrow true charge of what the news is supposed to be, which is, here's side A, here's side B, here's the data set, everybody. Now make up your own mind. You know,
yeah, that's what's missing out there. So drastically.
When movies are what's moving culture, when movies are what kids quote for their entire life, when movies are what, like, oh my God, man, this is just like that movie I saw when I was a kid. Oh, geez.
Well, now you've got Lil Gord over there.
If you are giving them a fear-based paradigm, yeah. Lil Gord.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I got Lil Gray. Gort meet Gray.
Hey.
Gray meet Gort.
Clock
telepathic communication going on there.
And, you know. But even then.
But
you know,
movies, you know, I mean, Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters, you know, and of course, The Day the Earth Stood Still, which I think was one of the finest films released on this subject. And very true, I think, in all of its aspects.
Well, and
we need more like that.
Well, you know? Well, that's just it. You know, more that push the envelope of the communication aspect, the idea of reaching out beyond our fears, because that's what we need even in our society, man. We have gotten to a point where people are so afraid of a conversation that they literally don't have Thanksgiving with family members anymore, Jack. That they don't have Christmas with family members anymore because they are afraid of a conversation with somebody that they love. And that's horrifying to me.
It is. It's horrifying to me too.
We have gotten to a huge point of letting fear rule the day and
demonizing each other. Just like they demonized E.T., we demonize each other. It's horrifying. And well, you hear people talking about civil war and all stuff. It's like,
my God, how do recently, you do that?
Okay.
It's not like the borders
divide us, you know.
On my own job site. With my own people, I heard during the cell phone outage, like 8 different people, like, you need to go have your wife go hit the bank and take all the money out.
Oh my geez,
can we have a cell phone outage for 4 hours?
I know. Like, everything's deep state, you know, and all that. Like, they would have a lot more power.
It was truly
than
that Anchorman moment of,
it's ridiculous.
Well, that escalated quickly, you know? I think Brick killed a man. man, Earl, thanks so much for coming on, for hashing this out,
Chris.
Talking about it. It's one of those, it's a document that I think everybody needs to go read. And read it with an open mind, you know, read it with, like I was saying, the thought of, sure, it's somebody on the way out of the office, but you know, on the way out, they left a few windows open, left a few doors open.
Chris is much kinder than I was. If you want to
read, make sure to go
is
read
an
Outer Earl's
Limits
work.
Magazine, and it will be in
next month's issue. Fantastic. Where can everybody go to read that? Where can they go to keep up with everything that you're doing with Southern California MUFON? Where can they go to keep up with everything with the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance?
For Outer Limits Magazine, I think that it's on Facebook. You can find it. Just put it in the Google engine. I didn't prepare to have their
that's
their
okay
contact information, but I do write a monthly article for them. Also, if you want to know what's going on in Southern California MUFON, it's SoCalMUFON.com, SoCalMUFON.com. You can find me on Facebook. I'm just Earl Gray on Facebook, but that's where I do a lot of my interaction with people. Also on LinkedIn, I'm there as Earl Gray Anderson, and I'm on the Twitter machine as Earl Gray Anderson.
That's right.
Hollywood Disclosure Alliance.org, amazing association. And do take a peek at what we're doing. Very proud of those guys. And there you go, Chris found him.
I'm pretty quick at it.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Chris Evers, wonderful magazine, and I'm proud to be writing for that. And Bob Spearing's writes a regular article too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, man, thank you as always for coming on, Earl. It's always fantastic talking with you. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. And of course, I'll be seeing you here in all of a couple months. I'm sure we'll have you on before then. Yeah, I can't wait. We have
blessings
symposium
to you,
coming
my friend.
Up. Hey, you two, take care. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. While you're online checking out all of the amazing work of Earl Gray Anderson, Southern California MUFON, as well as MUFON and the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to like, follow, subscribe. It's where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find all of our social media right here on the side. At the bottom of the page, there is also, there on the homepage, our schedule. which will show you all of our appearances, places like, you know, MUFON, everything else, all the places that we appear every year, all the conferences that we sponsor. So stop on by and check that out. Make sure to check out the Knowledge Vault, where you can find all of the declassified programs, especially the Arrow Historical Record Report that we were talking about tonight. Thank you, as always, everybody, for your time. Thank you for your open minds, your open hearts. Without those, the conversation does not happen. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, until next time, everybody, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, as well as KPNL Radio, APR TV, and the Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit groundzeromedia.org and aftermathmedia.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.